Talking Men with Matt Webb.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Welcome to the programme that shines the spotlight on some of the issues affecting men and boys in Cambridge. Over the next 60 minutes, we'll be exploring the topics of male loneliness, a trial using dogs to detect prostate cancer, and some of the issues raised by MPs during this year's International Men's Day debate in Parliament. But first, back in September, this happened.
The nominees are Talking Men from Cambridge 105. And the Bronze Award goes to the Cambridge 105 podcast.
Yes, that was Talking Men scooping bronze for Podcast of the Year at the annual Community Radio Awards. They took place in Bristol and I was proud to pick up the award. It's the first time a men's issue series has won a national radio award and I hope it will spur other radio stations to produce their own men's issues radio series.
Talking Men with Matt Webb.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Now, one in eight men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer in their lifetime. That's according to Cancer Research UK. But what's being done to spot the signs early on? Well, a trial's been taking place using dogs to detect the early signs of the cancer. Dr. Ian Frame from Prostate Cancer UK has been giving us his thoughts on it.
Anything that's quirky and sort of involves dogs will get people interested, which is a good thing. I think that the researchers themselves have problems in identifying what's an aggressive and a non-aggressive cancer by using the dogs. So we know the dogs are detecting something in the urine, but we don't know what it is. And we don't know whether it's aggressive or non-aggressive. So that, in a sense, doesn't take us any further forward than where we are just now. And if the dogs are detecting a cancer that isn't aggressive, then it's actually a retrograde step, because you would be diagnosing men who didn't have a prostate cancer that would kill them, whereas we can do better than that.
And I suppose that one of the things when I was looking at this story is that even if the dog's diagnosed, presumably they then still have to do the same kind of medical tests afterwards anyway. So is it just like an extra step?
It is, really. I mean, it's no different to the PSA, and we know that there are issues with the PSA of not detecting aggressive cancers and over-detecting cancers that won't kill. So we don't think that the dogs are doing anything different at the moment, and we don't know what they're detecting. So they may be sniffing PSA itself present in the urine, and we don't know how to standardise that. So they are detecting something, and we can be pleased about that, but until we know what it is they're detecting and that they can differentiate between the aggressive cancers and the non-aggressive cancers, then it's not taking the research any further forward. It's not benefiting men, and that's what we're trying to do.
So it's definitely not kind of a miracle breakthrough?
No, it's interesting and quirky, and if they can find out what's in the urine, what the dogs are detecting, then I think we can take that a step forward, and you could possibly develop a diagnostic test from that, but that's a long, long way down the line. And I think the medical detection dogs have a problem in being able to do the research that's needing to be done. You have to have dogs that we know aren't detecting prostate cancer. Do you know what I mean? So as well as detecting prostate cancer, we need to know that they're not detecting. So you would need to take a urine sample from a man over 50 who you thought didn't have prostate cancer, but he may have prostate cancer, and to be able to correlate that back and see whether the dog was accurately detecting and not detecting, then they have an issue. And as soon as you have an aggressive cancer, that man should be being treated. So are the dogs detecting what's treating them or not treating them? And we can't have biopsies in men who are not who don't have prostate cancer. It would be unethical. So there are issues for the people conducting these experiments to get the proof that we need that would then get a better diagnostic test. So at the moment, all they're saying is these dogs can detect prostate cancer. They're not saying that they don't detect when a prostate cancer isn't there.
It's hard to have a control.
It's very hard to have the control group that you need, yeah.
But I guess one side of it is for charities like yours, I guess it's good, it gets people talking and puts it back in the public domain.
I think it's excellent that people are talking about prostate cancer, they're talking about how to detect it and the need to detect it, because that's what we're trying to do. So we know that if you detect it early, you will survive longer and you'll go into a better treatment regime. I think the issue still is that there are cancers that will not kill, so we have to stop diagnosing those cancers or treating those cancers that won't kill, while making sure that the aggressive cancers are given, men with aggressive cancers are given the best treatment possible. And that's what we're trying to do and what we're trying to achieve. I think ultimately we would like to see a screening program in the same way there is for breast and colorectal cancers. So to do that, you need to have a very accurate way of testing the cancer, and we don't have the PSA doesn't do that, and the PSA could lead to a biopsy which is painful, could be infected, may be unnecessary if the cancer isn't at that level. So I think it's the whole package of diagnosis is just not quite there in prostate cancer, and that's what we're aiming to do, to get a sort of a risk-based assessment tool that is suitable for screening and fits in with everything else that's been done. So it's really exciting research being done on imaging, so using MRI, all sorts of stuff coming through that we think will help build the case to have a proper screening program and an effective screening program for prostate cancer.
But you'd caution against this? You'd be wary about people getting excited about this?
Well, I mean, I think if you think about it, the cost of training the dogs, of maintaining the dogs, it's never going to be somewhere where every urine sample from a man suspected of having prostate cancer is sent for a routine testing using this technique. I think where we can get excited is that if the dogs with their very sensitive noses are detecting something in urine that can point to a man having an aggressive prostate cancer, then we really are onto something and we could take that out. But I don't think it's about on a daily basis the dogs going around in the carousel sniffing out prostate cancer in urine. That's not where I think this is heading. I think if it's going to head anywhere, it's got to be into identifying what these chemicals are and then using them in a better diagnostic test. But it has to be detecting a cancer that's aggressive. It cannot be just the sort of you cannot just say that they're detecting prostate cancer and be done with it. There are many prostate cancers. Some of them are aggressive and some of them not.
So you think it could potentially be used in conjunction with everything we've got now?
Again, I think if they can detect something, it's not about using the dogs on a daily basis for routine diagnostic testing. I think it's find out what the dogs are detecting. And we don't know whether these dogs are detecting the same thing at the same level. You just have a dog stopping on the carousel saying this sample has prostate cancer in it and or a volatile compound. So you have to get away from that and say, well, what is it? Can we isolate it? And if we can isolate it, can we use it in a much more rigorous diagnostic process?
At this stage, what are the problems? What are your concerns about people getting excited about this?
I think the problem is that while we're reporting that the dogs are detecting prostate cancer, we don't know what grade of prostate cancer detecting, so whether it's a prostate cancer that will kill or is a prostate cancer that is harmless, so that's important. And also what we don't know is if the dogs don't detect prostate cancer that isn't there, so it's a double negative. I know that's confusing, but we have to know that they're not falsely detecting a prostate cancer and they're not missing any prostate cancers that could be there. So there's a few things there that they still have to get right before we could get excited about it.
Dr. Ian Frame giving his reaction to a trial using dogs to detect the early signs of prostate cancer.
Talking Men with Matt Webb.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Now, an estimated 8 million men feel lonely once a week, while for nearly 3 million, it's a daily occurrence. It's a growing problem across the UK and indeed in Cambridge. But how does it really affect the modern man? Dilair Sheikh is 26 and lives here in the city. He's been speaking to me about his experience of dealing with loneliness, anxiety and depression, which first started when he was a teenager. I started by asking him if he was surprised at the stats.
No, if I'm honest, I'm not surprised, to be honest. I feel like loneliness, depression or mental health issues are a big problem that a lot of men face, and I think most men are afraid to actually talk about it. I feel like whilst I don't particularly feel there is enough help and mental health services aren't good enough in this country, I feel it's harder as a man because there is this expectation that you're supposed to be strong. So it's like almost you're not really supposed to talk about feeling lonely, feeling depressed, feeling scared. You're not supposed to cry, for example. And I think it's realizing that these things happen and it's not making you less of a man.
So how did loneliness affect you? Where did it all start?
Right, well, I mean, I suppose I can't say I've you know, I'm sure there's people with far worse things happen to them in their lives than I have. However, I've had a few problems, for example, at home with my parents, and my parents didn't have a particularly good relationship with each other, and as a result there were a lot of arguments at home, and that kind of made me isolate myself and kind of withdraw from everything as a way of protecting myself. And that's something I kind of transferred outside of the home. So it's something I did when I was at school growing up. I didn't have many friends because I basically kept to myself, and as a result a lot of the time I was feeling quite lonely. And this went on for quite a while, and as I said, I've struggled with it for years, and I got better at making friends as I got older, but I feel like I still always felt the same problems. And occasionally, even when you're with your friends, you can still kind of feel lonely and isolated, like you're just not connecting with everyone else who's there. And yeah, as I said, it's gotten better recently, and only recently I've tried to start seeking help about my issues.
What states of mind did you have during that period of your life?
The other states of mind I've had, for example, is, you know, you start to kind of hate yourself, and you don't feel like there's a lot of people out there who can actually help you or understand, or in some way sometimes you feel like if you do ask for help, as I said, you're feeling like less of a man, so you're feeling like you shouldn't be asking for help and you should just be tough. So there's that to deal with. So it's sort of, you get a mixture of kind of loneliness, self-loathing.
When did you start to realise it was affecting your mental health?
Well, I suppose not just loneliness, but also me realising that there was obviously an issue with my mental health was just probably in the last year. I've never before this been in a relationship with anyone because I always was kind of afraid, and I didn't realize that was a symptom. Actually, I didn't realize that was due to my mental health issues that I had. So when I got together with my current girlfriend, I realized that some of the feelings I was having weren't normal, and she obviously encouraged me to get help for them.
And how are you now? How are you managing your mental health?
It's been up and down because I still have problems opening up about my feelings. So it was getting better for a while when I did counselling. I stopped doing counselling for a while because I felt just, you know, I started making excuses. I started saying, you know, I don't need it, I feel fine. You know, I could sort it out just by talking. And one thing that helps, obviously, is you need to talk about it. You need to talk about it with everyone. You need to talk about it with your partner. If you have a partner, you need to talk about it with your friends. You need to be able to talk about it with your family. And if you're unable to do that, it's really hard to actually get over anything. And as I said, there's been ups and downs, but definitely talking about it since starting counselling has improved things for me because it has made me more willing to talk about what's going on.
What message would you give to a guy listening after hearing your story?
Just that, as I said, if anyone does end up listening to this, that they shouldn't be afraid to seek help, that they should talk to everyone that's close to them in their lives. To be honest, if their friends, if their family, if they don't support them, if they don't understand, if they don't say this is okay, if they kind of say man up, then those aren't friends worth having, if I'm honest. But generally, I would say to people, you would honestly be surprised. You would think that people would judge you and people would hate you, but people are really your friends, they won't. They'll only support you. And I definitely encourage anyone listening to kind of speak about their issues. And as I said, don't be afraid to seek help. Don't be afraid to cry, because it doesn't make you less of a man.
Dilett Air Sheikh from Cambridge there telling me about his experiences of loneliness and mental health.
Talking Men. with Matt Webb.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
When you think of domestic violence, what's the first thought that comes into your mind? Well, it's probably a man hitting a woman, but that isn't always the case. The number of men coming forward seeking help because they themselves are a victim of domestic violence is on the rise. That's according to the charity Mankind Initiative. Joining me now to discuss the often hidden subject of male victims of domestic abuse is their chairman, Mark Brooks. Firstly, tell us about your background in supporting victims of domestic abuse.
When I was a local councillor many years ago in Bexley, and one of my constituents actually was a man. He had a couple of children and he needed some help in terms of support for him and his children in being getting some emergency housing. So when I took his case up, it was really difficult for me to convince the council that A, he needed emergency housing, and also that a man could ever be a victim of domestic abuse. So I managed to get him help and got him sorted. But when I stopped trying to be in frontline politics, which was about 12 years ago, I decided that I wanted to volunteer for a charity. And I remembered this particular case and therefore went on the internet, found the Mankind Initiative, said I would volunteer to support them on their public policy media work. And then within a year, they asked me to be chair, which I've been doing now for a decade.
So what does the Mankind Initiative do and what services do you offer?
Well, we're a national charity that supports male victims of domestic abuse. And we do that in three ways. We provide direct support through a national helpline. We've got a really good website that has lots of information and tips and tools for men. But also we support the growth of the sector in terms of making sure that there's support for every male victim of domestic abuse in every town and city in the UK. So we have training course. We also have a national conference, and also we provide a directory of male services. The last area is that we really speak up for male victims. We give them a public voice and a public platform. So we're always talking to the media about the need to recognise male victims and support them. But also we run campaigns and we lobby politicians. And only a couple of weeks ago, I had a meeting with the government minister regarding the incoming Domestic Abuse and Violence Act. So we do all of that. All that type of activity you would expect a charity nowadays to do.
Now, you say you've spoken to the government minister responsible. Were they welcoming of the work that Mankind does and helping male victims?
They are, actually. And I think one of the key things that I've seen in the 10 years that I've been involved has been a real shift in attitudes from the police, from the health service, from local councils, and the government in terms of recognising male victims. But there's still a long way to go, and especially at government level, because and as we know, victims of domestic abuse harm men, including male victims of sexual abuse, sexual violence, stalking, honour-based crimes. They're actually classed as being victims of crimes against a woman or a girl, and that's a government policy in supporting those types of crimes. So if you're a man, that's not really helpful for you. It doesn't recognise you as a male victim. And we're really up pushing now for the government to actually have a parallel strategy which recognises women and girls, and rightly so, but also looks at men and boys separately. And that's an issue we're really pushing now.
Now, according to your stats from the Mankind Initiative website, the equivalent of 1.4 million men have experienced partner abuse since the age of 16. Now, that's quite a shocking statistic, which might alarm a lot of people.
For every victim of partner abuse in the UK, two of those victims will be a woman and one of those victims would be a man. So whenever I say those statistics, people are surprised, but you know, their Home Office, their government figures. And where we're getting to now is that the recognition that men are victims, but the recognising the volume of the number of male victims that there are is the next step beyond just recognising there are victims. We now need to recognise how many there actually are.
Is it an underreported crime? And if so, why do you think that's the case?
In terms of male victims, it is an underreported crime. I mean, I would say it's underreported for female victims as well as men. And certainly, you know, as is always clear in all the work we do, you know, domestic abuse issues is not a competition between male victims and female victims. But when it comes to men, men are far more likely not to tell anybody that they're a victim. They're three times more likely than a woman not to tell anyone they're a victim, and they're less likely to tell the police. They're less likely to help to tell a health professional or a friend or a family member. And we think that comes down to a number of things. Firstly, there's the whole issue around masculinity in terms of men feeling ashamed that they're a victim, feeling that they won't be believed, feeling that there's something wrong with them. So there's what we call a male script. And, you know, when the man is a victim, they feel that it undermines their sense of what it means to be a man. And it does. And secondly, we think that there's still issues in society where society doesn't recognise male victims in the same way that it recognises female victims. And also it doesn't look out for men in the same way that it does for women. So societal change is a big problem, as is the whole issue about being a male victim undermines a man's sense of what it means to be a man. The one thing I would say, though, is that we have no truck whatsoever with recent campaigns about saying masculinity is toxic. Masculinity isn't toxic. Masculinity is a force for good and always has been in the world. I think the issue is about how we can change society and the way society delivers support to vulnerable men, which needs to be changed.
What's the provision like for refuges and safe houses for men? Are there enough available for the volume of men coming forward these days?
Well, in terms of refuge and safe houses, there's not enough for everyone. But certainly in terms of men, I mean, at the moment, there's 23 organisations in the UK offering about 93 safe house or refuge places for men, and only about a quarter of those are actually dedicated to men. So the other three quarters are available for men and women, which we don't have a problem with, as long as there's places for men to go. But there's huge swathes of the country where there aren't any refuge or safe houses, and where there are these places, they're always nearly full the whole time. The other question, of course, is, you know, well, what does a man do and where does a man go if he's got children? Because it isn't about just him escaping. A man won't escape from a situation that he finds himself in and leave his children with a violent partner or another violent adult. So there's a huge shortage of refuge safe house places, and there certainly is for male victims. It's one of those issues which is, I believe, and the charity believes, is a real scandal.
Do you think the government needs to step in and help?
Yeah, the government needs to increase the amount of support generally for male victims, but also in terms of refuge and safe houses. But it's not always the government, it's the police. It's about local councils, housing associations and other organisations who do have funding pots available for domestic abuse. They need to up their game as well. Not everyone, but certainly many.
Now, it's International Men's Day on Sunday. Do you welcome this as an opportunity to highlight the work your organisation's doing and get conversations going?
Any discussion about men's well-being and men's vulnerability, and of course that includes boys, is always welcome, because it's very rare that this actually happens at a national level, let alone at a local level. And, you know, the continually having debates around International Men's Day, around suicide, boys' education, sexual abuse, sexual violence, and all of these, and men's mental health more widely, is really welcome. International Men's Day provides that window of opportunity, and we have over 50 different events now in the UK over the next couple of weeks marking International Men's Day, is really welcome. The issue, though, is, you know, talk is cheap, it's about action. And the key thing is that having these debates in Parliament is all well and good, but if nothing changes and in a year's time there's another debate and there still isn't any specific support targeted at ending male suicide, there isn't any policies that are talk about closing the gender education gap, where at present 62,000 fewer boys and men every year in Britain go to university than girls and women. Unless there's policies and action to close those gaps, then nothing will change. So talk and conversation, getting those issues on the agenda, it's very welcome, but now's the time for action.
Do you think a Minister for Men would help address the issues you've mentioned?
In terms of a Minister for Men, yes, I would, because there's lots of arguments about whether we should have a Minister for Women, and, you know, whether we should have a minister for any gender. And, you know, I understand those discussions, but, you know, in terms of real politic, no one realistically is going to stop having a Minister for Women. And to be honest, I'm comfortable with that. What I'm not comfortable is that for the last 20 years, we haven't had a Minister for Men. And one of the outcomes or symptoms of not having a Minister for Men is that nobody's really looking at a policy around boys' education. No one's looking at a policy around men's mental health. No one's looking at a policy around male victims of sexual violence or domestic abuse. And the reason, one of the reasons for that is because there isn't a Minister for Men in a government who's actually raising those issues at a senior level in government. And that is a problem. And that needs to be rectified. So, you know, from a personal basis, it really is time for now to have a Minister for Men. And, you know, this is something I actually wrote about nearly 10 years ago. So, you know, I've got form in this. You know, I've been campaigning for this for a long time.
And finally, if there's a man listening who sees themselves as a victim of domestic abuse, what's the contact details of your organisation so they can start to get the help they might desperately need?
Well, the first thing I would say is that, you know, if you are a male victim, you're not alone, you're not weak, and you're not to blame. It's not your fault. And importantly, there is help out there. So you can call us on 01823 33 42 44. Go to our website, mankind.org.uk. But importantly, if you're in immediate danger, please ring 999. The police will help.
Mark Brooks, chairman of the Mankind Initiative, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Talking Men with Matt Webb.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
International Men's Day takes place on the 19th of November every year. It's a chance to discuss some of the issues affecting men and boys in Cambridge and around the world. Once again, there was a debate in Parliament back in November to discuss the issues such as fatherhood, male victims of domestic violence, male homelessness and men's mental health. The debate was put forward by the Conservative MP Jeremy Lefroy, who opened up proceedings.
I'll start, Mr. Austin, with role models, and I'd like to recognise today the huge number of men in the UK who daily work positively for their families and their communities, who actively promote equality, not just in words, but in their actions. It's often asked, where are the male role models who can inspire other men and boys? And the answer is, they're in every community, but they often need to be encouraged to share their experiences, their difficulties, as well as their successes. By their very nature, good role models are often reticent to speak about themselves, and often do not even recognise themselves as role models. They think they're just doing their best, often in difficult circumstances. I think of a close friend of mine who's a great role model through his role as a leader of an organisation which works with hundreds of young people in North Staffordshire. He would be the last person to recognise himself as a role model, but he is, including to me. So how can we support such people? I would suggest that promoting people publicly as role models is not necessarily the best, or certainly the only way. Everyone has their failings, and there's nothing which some of the media like better than to raise someone up, only to knock them down when they turn out to have feet of clay, as we all do. However, supporting the work of those who are genuine, but often unassuming role models, and who are having a positive influence on men and boys, and women and girls, can be really effective. And it's not difficult to identify them. Ask most local councillors, community workers, police officers, PCSOs, and they will let you know who are great role models on the ground. Then see how they can be supported in their work and perhaps supported to expand it. Government's answer to a problem is often new initiatives involving new organisations which are given substantial sums of money. And when the money runs out, the organisation folds. Much better, in my opinion, where possible, to help existing people or organisations which have a proven track record over many years. I'll turn now, Mr. Austin, to health and well-being. Men are more likely than women to die prematurely, and one in five men dies before the age of 65. Mortality among those from cardiovascular diseases, from those under 75, is twice as high among men as women, and for diseases considered preventable, three times as high. And cancer under those under 75, mortality rates are almost twice as high for men as women, and in cases of preventable cancer, 17%. So there's so much more work to do in improving men's health.
I particularly wanted to talk about healthcare and particularly mental health in terms of men and boys, because I think this is one area that is hugely an issue, and it's something which starts from very early on. We heard some of the statistics in the opening speech about how men are more likely to commit suicide, and indeed that is the biggest cause of death for men under the age of 45. And it really prompts us as a society to take a step back and to look about what services we're actually providing for men when they are finding themselves in trouble. And also that stigma element, which I think we are starting to break down. In recent years, there's been a welcome move towards talking more openly about mental health. And I know in the chamber, honourable members from different parties have spoken very movingly about their own battles with mental health problems. And I think that's very much to be welcomed. But equally, I don't think anybody would suggest that we are there yet when it comes to breaking down that stigma. And also, importantly, making sure the services are there. For too long, mental health has been the Cinderella of the health service. It should be treated on parity with physical health problems. And as yet, those resources are not yet there in our communities when it comes to mental health provision for individuals who need that support.
One of the reasons that I'm particularly interested in this subject is that I have the honour of being, back in the early 90s, the first dad, the first father working for Barclays Bank to take paternity leave and to request and achieve a change in my working pattern to help balance my life and my work responsibilities with that of being a new dad. And today that isn't remarkable, that many big companies like Barclays are doing are providing this, but certainly 20 years ago, over 20 years ago, it was quite unusual. And we've certainly seen progress in this area today, but I do believe that there is more that needs to be done to enable dads to balance the many pressures and challenges that that we face today with our work-life balance.
Awareness is something that is so important, and men, especially men of the older age bracket, are so reticent to talk about problems and symptoms. We need to break the cycle and to train our young men to know that there is nothing wrong with talking about health or issues which may be slightly awkward. The International Men's Day website has a very eye-catching first paragraph. We know that men's health is worse than women's in almost every part of the world. The recent World Health Organization data shows that globally male life expectancy at birth in 2015 was 69 years of age. For females, it was 74 years of age. Women on a worldwide basis live 5 years longer than men. We know that 95% of workplace fatalities are men, and that 99% of combat deaths are men. These are the stats as the World Health Organization has put forward. It's past time that we stopped being so reticent about discussing things and began to realise that, to quote the old phone advert, it's good to talk.
A few years ago, I said that men were being treated more harshly in the criminal justice system than women. It was worth reiterating at that time, the exact opposite was being said both in this chamber, in Westminster Hall debate that I held once, that was being asserted that it was actually the other way around, and even ministers were claiming it was the other way around. But I'm delighted to say that this is one battle that has been won, and we now, people do accept that men are treated more harshly in the criminal justice system than women. Even the research carried out in the course of the Lammy Review concluded males were independently associated with approximately 83% higher odds of being sentenced to imprisonment compared to females. So we can have victories for common sense. We just need some more. Men are increasingly getting a bad press, and I think that this needs to be challenged. And it seems bizarre to me that those who apparently fight discrimination, injustices and stereotypes are quite happy often to perpetuate all of those things against men. So when thinking about International Men's Day, let's remind ourselves that there are men who are victims of unequal pay. There are men who are victims of discrimination and harassment. You wouldn't think it when you see all the headlines about equal pay gaps only mentioning women. But they don't mention part-time male workers who are paid less than their female counterparts. For various reasons, the overall pay gap is not a result, in my view, of widespread discrimination. But if they say that it is, then surely they should be equally outraged about the pay gap which has men as the losers, part-time pay. Surely the logic is that they must be the victims of discrimination too. There are also certainly men who are victims of domestic violence, and men are more likely, far more likely, to be victims of violence generally. Men are victims of sexual assaults and rapes. Men are victims of stalking and controlling behaviour. Men are victims of so-called honour-based violence too. Every single victim of a crime is important, and preventing these crimes against anyone, male or female, should be a priority. The focus on solely women's and girls is serious. And just to give one example of how dangerous it can be, a serious case review led to Bradford Council and the police apologising for letting down a 14-year-old boy who was groomed by dozens of men. Phil Mitchell of the Blast Project in Bradford said, "I think the fact he was a boy was an issue. If the police had got a call that a girl was planning to sleep with an older man, then I think officers would have responded with more urgency."
The question is that this House has considered International Men's Day.
Philip Davis concluding our look back at the International Men's Day debate in Parliament. I also spoke to Glenn Paul, UK coordinator of International Men's Day, and from the Stop Male Suicide Project in Australia. He started by telling me what got him interested in men's issues.
For me, very much it was fatherhood. So I was an at-home dad 20 years ago, and that was quite interesting in itself, seeing the barriers that there are to dads being involved in their kids' lives. So I got involved in writing about that experience and talking to other dads who were at-home dads and struggling in different ways, and coming up against some quite sexist attitudes towards men with kids. So that was quite an eye-opener. And I lived in the London borough of Hackney at the time, which had this reputation for being the most, politically correct borough in the entire world. And yet you could still walk into a doctor's surgery or a council swimming pool and see all these signs for directed at mothers with babies, and with no acknowledgement of the fact that there were fathers with babies there. So that was quite interesting. And then I had the misfortune to go through separation when my daughter was sort of between 2 and 3 years old, and discovered just how appalling the whole system around family breakdown and what we do to ensure that mums and dads stay involved in their kids' lives when they can no longer get on with each other or live together. And I was fortunate to be given joint custody, kind of despite of, not because of the system. I then got very involved. I thought, well, if I found it so difficult, and I was a full-time at-home dad, how difficult must it be for your traditional father, who's, sure, involved, hands-on, involved in childcare in some way, but is actually the primary breadwinner and spends most of the time out of the home. And that's when I really started to discover some of the real difficult circumstances that separated fathers were facing in the UK and around the world. And got massively involved in campaigning for family law reform and for better rights for separated dads. Good dads who wanted to be fully involved in their kids' lives but were being stopped for various reasons because our system isn't set up to support separated fathers very well. So that's where it started for me. It's like many people who are passionate campaigners and advocates, there's a personal journey there. It's about my personal story, but I've carried on regardless of that. Because, I'm a fully involved father, I've got a great relationship with my daughter, which is constantly evolving, so there's not like a sense of personal bitterness there. But that really, that personal lived experience, I think, is massively important if you're sort of trying to advocate for a group in society, particularly a group, men and boys, who aren't very often recognised as a group that's in need of help and support.
Yeah, well, quite often we see on television campaigns for girls and women. Do you think that men and boys get a rough deal when it comes to the state supporting them?
Massively. There's just a complete and utter lack of any kind of political structure to support men and boys in the issues they face. And what you tend to find is that where women and girls face an issue, and I have always been an advocate for support for men and boys in addition to women and girls, not in opposition to women and girls. I want to make that really clear. It's not a them versus us competition. But if you just look at, you know, where's the Minister for Men? Where is the strategy to prevent male suicide? I'm involved in a new initiative in the UK called the Coalition for Men and Boys, and there's consultation going on with the big lottery fund. Where is the funding stream? We all, you know, many people buy their ticket on a Wednesday or a Saturday to support the lottery, and there are tens of millions of pounds of that money goes specifically to women and girls initiatives. Where's the fund for men and boys? And it's not like people don't know there's an issue. You know, the Big Lottery Fund did a fantastic report 4 years ago highlighting the fact that very little of their money was going to men and boys, either to projects that specifically and only targeted men and boys, but also even in projects which were theoretically open to everyone and around issues which mostly affect, even around issues which mostly affected men, the Big Lottery found that men were not benefiting from the projects that they were setting up in the same way that women were. It's not like it's a big unknown, but we still continue to fail to act on the recommendations that come out of any kind of initiative like that, which is really simple. You have to target men and boys as a distinct group with specific needs. But that requires us to go beyond the gender story that we have, which is quite simply, men are problems and women have problems. So until we change that thinking, the idea that women are at the effect of society and the problems that they cause are created collectively, and men are their own worst enemy, that men actually cause all their own problems. And we need to shift that thinking and treat men and boys the same as we treat women and girls, which is it was a group of people who, guess what, going through life, have some problems and need some help and support.
Now, on the steps of Downing Street, Theresa May, when she became Prime Minister, said that she wanted to target a whole host of areas where people face discrimination or aren't succeeding. And she mentioned about white boys in education. Elaborate on what issues there are around white boys in education and how they're lagging behind.
Yeah, I think specifically it was white working class boys, which is, again, this is nothing new. I first heard a politician talking about this in my time working in local government over in West London. And in fairness, it was a Labour councillor, Ruth Cadbury, who's now a member of Parliament, who first highlighted this. So the new Labour government wasn't particularly good at highlighting and addressing that so much. They did some work, to be fair, but it's just clear statistically, Matt, that if you look at how boys generally are performing in education, the education system is failing them compared to girls.
Now, you've gone on to found the Stop Male Suicide campaign in Australia. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so because of my personal circumstances, I'm in a long-term relationship with an Australian citizen, and I've been on a long-term promise to move over here once my daughter went off to university, which I fulfilled on became an Australian resident in December 2015. And I have been coming over here and working particularly with the men's health sector in Australia, which is excellent. Small, but excellent. Things like Movember came out of Australia, and the men's sheds movement for older men came out of Australia. So Australia's doing some really innovative stuff. But in the UK, one of the organisations I was lucky to work with on quite regularly is the Campaign Against Living Miserably, Calm UK, which is one of the few charities in the world which focuses specifically on male suicide. And there's no equivalent organisation in Australia. So in terms of working out where I could best make a difference here, I decided to set up this project, the Stop Male Suicide Project. And what we're doing is we're travelling around and running a series of 8 mini conferences, bring stop male suicide in New South Wales, stop male suicide in Western Australia, so on and so forth, and bringing together as many different people who are committed to stopping male suicide in that particular area and finding out what's out there and finding out what we can do to make a difference, because it's a massive issue. 13 men a day kill themselves in the UK. In Australia, it's 6 men a day and are 3 times more likely to take their own lives. And it's another of those issues where we go, ah, right, okay, well, that's because men don't get help. And it's like, oh, come on, get over it, will you? It's not about men not getting help. It's about us collectively being rubbish at helping men and not addressing the many issues that men face that can set them on the path to suicide.
I'm always staggered by the statistic that suicide is the biggest killer of males under the age of 45 in the UK. It's an awful statistic. What more do you think the UK government could do to try and bring these numbers down, and what more support services do you think there should be worldwide to help men?
Yeah, number one, let's have a minister for men. You know, it's like going around Australia, and it's the same in the UK. Every single state has got a minister for women. Every single state has got an office for women, someone who's responsible for women's issues. There's no one in government whose job it is simply to make sure that men are okay. And that's a massive missing. If we think that's the right way to address women's issues, why do we not give men's issues the same way? That says an awful lot. You know, we say, I often argue, we say, you know, we're very quick to say that men won't get help with their issues, but then who's helping men with men's issues? Why, you know, it's a real hypocrisy for politicians. I had a go at Jeremy Corbyn last year around about International Men's Day. I mean, give him credit, he actually mentioned male suicide, but he just kind of went, oh, it's macho culture, men don't talk, women do, men don't talk. And it's like, oh, come on. It's like, your party will not talk about men's issues, and then you attack men for not talking about their issues. Like, what? Lead by example. Tell us who your shadow minister for men's issues is. So until someone at the height of government takes responsibility for men's issues and specifically male suicide, then we can't see any change. And that goes right down from, you know, the United Nations through to the EU, which we are still part of, just I think, down to national government, down to local government. It filters down and down and down through all the systems of government.
Do you think that we'll see a Minister for Men in our lifetimes?
Yeah, I think that it's going to happen at some point. And there's always this thing about be careful what you wish for, because then it's actually, well, what is their responsibility? Because what you can guarantee is that, and this is where we do come into conflict with the world of women's issues. I mean, I said right at the beginning, this is not, you know, them and us. It's not about, you know, helping men instead of helping women. It's about helping men in addition to women. But this is where the two sort of movements supporting men's issues and women's issues come into conflict, because women's issues is framed very much as women having problems and men being problems. When advocates for men come into the gender issues space, the expectation is that our role will be to address the problems that men cause, not the problems that men have. So it will be, oh, yes, right, we need a minister for men, and that minister for men needs to stop all the violence that men commit, and all the problems that men commit. So I think we will. I think it will start off subtly. It's inevitable. It'll be maybe like a junior minister or a minister in the Equalities Department who also has responsibility for men and boys or has responsibility for all gender issues or something like that. And there'll be massive pressure on them to support, to do only do work to support women's issues as opposed to doing work to support men's issues. So it'll happen, Matt, but it'll be messy, because that's where the struggle will be. It's like turning a beetle. You know the whole thing, you turn a beetle on its back? I'm sure you don't torture insects, but if you turn a beetle on its back, it struggles to right itself. And saying to people that you need to address the problems that men have, as distinct from the problems that men are, is like turning a beetle on its back. It's as challenging to gender norms as the Prime Minister, but the Prime Minister's a woman now. Keep up with the times, then. As a leading male minister suddenly walking down the street in a dress, everyone would turn and go, "That's not right. He should be wearing trousers. He should be wearing a suit, right?" And it's exactly what happens when you stand up and say men have problems and they need help. People, men and women, will start. Will either ignore you, laugh at you, point at you, or attack you. So standing up for men's issues is massively challenging to our beliefs about gender, which is why it's difficult. And it's and a lot of people who do really good work with men and boys say, oh, we shouldn't make a fuss, we should just do it quietly under the radar. And I understand that because it's a lot easier to do that than to put your neck on the line and face all the kind of attacks and condemnation you're going to get if you stand up as an advocate for men, because it's the same as, not the same, but it's similar to a man suddenly putting on a dress and walking down the street. People will stare. People will attack him. People might even hit him, abuse him, because he's defying the gender norms. And thank heavens we now live in a society where that's starting to be recognised, and people are advocating for the right of people to express their gender in whatever way they want at an individual level. But what we haven't done is taken the stand for people to advocate for their gender politics. There's a real dominant hold in the world of gender politics on who can and can't be part of that world.
Glenn Poole there.
Talking Men with Matt Webb.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Now, the 1st of November marked the start of Movember. It's where men grow moustaches to raise awareness of men's health. My Sky News colleague Sarah J. Mee takes up the story.
Now, possibly to the sadness of women everywhere, the 1st of November means a lot more than the start of November. It actually means the start of Movember, more than just a movement to get men growing their moustaches. The foundation is a charity which is working hard to tackle serious men's health issues such as prostate cancer, testicular cancer and mental health. Well, here with us to talk about Movember, the TV personality Jesse McClure, who you'll recognise, of course, from Storage Hunters, and Chief Executive of the Movember Foundation, Owen Sharp. Welcome to you both.
Yes.
Nick is here alongside me as well. And women everywhere will be prepared for the longest month ever as their other halves desperately try to grow a moustache. Because let's face it, Jesse, some men can do it better than others.
Well, and I'm one of those, I think. And it's a weird thing. I'm feeling very naked this morning because I've had sideburns for the last 7 years of my life. And this is the first time I've fully shaven. So
you're starting
terrifying.
From scratch. Literally.
Yes. My team sideburns fans are very disappointed.
Sorry.
Right
how
now.
Long do they normally go?
Well, it takes me about 2 to 4 hours to grow back. So yeah, we're going to be
right.
Okay. But right now I'm
you'll
feeling.
You'll be full on Team Wolf by the
yeah,
end of the month.
Yeah, I know. That's how it goes.
But Owen, we do talk about Movember every year.
Yeah.
And it just gets bigger and bigger. Yeah. I mean, it's not just men getting involved. They have their Mo sisters,
yeah,
the women
absolutely.
Who support them on this journey throughout the month. How much awareness are you raising and just how big has Movember become?
It's huge. It's a big thing. I guess we would argue it needs to be bigger because the issues that we're there for are still pretty prominent, particularly now that we're talking more about mental health and preventing suicide and 3 out of 4 people who take their own lives are men. And we need to keep talking about this. And that's what's amazing about the moustache. It's a conversation starter. Mm. And actually, we know conversations save lives because men in particular don't talk early enough. They don't go and seek help. They don't say they're struggling. They don't say they might have a problem with their physical health. Mm. And just getting into the habit of doing that by growing this daft thing on your face means that you actually have a better opportunity to do it all year round.
And Jesse, why did you want to get involved? What's your particular affiliation with Movember?
Yeah. I've come here as an American, you know, filming my own stuff and living the celebrity high life. But through the course of the whole thing, I found out last year that I got diagnosed with testicular cancer. So living that celebrity high life, or at least I thought so in my head, gave me a real reality check. And it's funny, I shared this story with Owen, but I remember all my goofy friends a long time ago growing mustaches for some weird November event. Because I thought it was a goofy fad. But when I got the call at 3 a.m. in a premiere in Blackpool saying that I have to come home immediately to take care of this, the first thing I thought of was my boys growing mustaches, saying that the early detection and taking care of it immediately is the most important thing. And that's why I'm partnering with Movember, is because whether or not they knew it, they had a big impact on saving my life.
Yeah, and Jesse, how are you now?
You know, I got to go home in a few weeks and still continue the treatment and the process. Luckily, I detected it early, so everything's going great. Mm-hmm. I've surrounded myself with amazing friends and my family. I have my lovely Essex girlfriend, Nicole, who's guiding me along the way. She's actually general manager of the gym group who's partnered with Movember. So apparently I'm climbing Kilimanjaro. So on the steps. So, you know, I think she's helping so much in terms of not just my mental health, but my physical health as well. So it's a continuous battle, but partnering with Movember and some great people, I think, is what's helping this so much and making me stay positive in life.
And Owen, how can people, well, a lot of sports stars are growing moustaches, don't they? We see them across the Premier League, rugby, all sports. They all get involved.
League Two, don't forget, Accrington Stanley as well.
Accrington Stanley, they'll be sporting some great moustaches. But Owen, in terms of getting men involved, this is a great way to do it because it encourages men to have a bit of fun with it as well. And some of these men really go to town, don't they, with their moustaches?
Oh, yeah. We see some really fantastic mos and people like Jesse who clearly are very proficient in the art of facial hair.
Yeah, have we got a design in mind? Because if you're cultivating quite a big moustache, you've got a lot of...
Yeah, I go for the half beard. I'm a sideburn guy, so I got to represent. You know, I'm not a moustache guy.
It's the sideburns that grow up into the moustache. They're particularly impressive. Yeah. That's very good.
I like it.
It's a lot of manscaping every morning.
Absolutely.
That's what it's called, right?
It is.
Called. Brilliant. Well, thank you for coming in to talk to us.
Jesse McClure and Owen Sharp there. If you've been affected by any of the stories we've discussed over the last hour, details of the support services available will be on the podcast listing for this programme at cambridge105.co.uk. That wraps up this edition of Talking Men. We'll be back in 2018 with a brand new show, so do join me then. Thank you very much for listening.